right now I'll fill in this wonderful device, attach it to my belt, and I would like to thank you, first of all, for the invitation to come here to Perimeter, and it's my pleasure to be here in this institution. I heard about Perimeter for so many years, and finally I'm here. I'm very pleased to be in this institute, and I'm happy for you to have such a wonderful building, excellent facilities. Coming here from JPL, it's quite a difference. So it's a very pleasant environment. For me personally, to be in Canada is also very exciting because this is my first trip to Canada. I was born in Siberia, where they say we all born with our hockey sticks in hands and on skates. So essentially now I came to the country that actually has the same tradition, so to speak. And especially looking at the pointer here, I'm very impressed with the excellent high-tech device that you are using here in this institute. Amazing. Allowing me to use a low-tech device here to point things on the charts. With this, I'd like to sort of bring you to a different reality. I understand that you don't have a pleasure to hear many experimental talks in this institute, but allow me to slightly infringe of your on your tradition here. I will be talking about a laser astrometric test of relativity, a mission that is designed to test effects of gravity on light to the second order gravitational constant. Before I will go there, I'd like to introduce people who contributed to this presentation. And of course, Michael Shao is a person who is well known in astrometric interferometry. Michael essentially came from MIT, went to JPL, and actually worked on the same interferometer that Michelson was using for his experiments. So we still have those wonderful devices that Michelson was using in Mount Wilson. And if you go in Pasadena, if you go to Caltech, you just drive up, and you see those. This interferometer is being on display. But Michael Shao, he came to JPL not to work on this interferometer, but rather to build other instruments. And those instruments are now displayed, and they're working in Southern California, in Palomar, now Keck interferometer on Hawaii, and also a very important development that is very relevant to the mission that I will be talking today is a space interferometry mission. So optical interferometry is becoming reality, and the accuracy that we are gaining from these instruments are very important. And of course, Kenneth Norbert. Ken was the motivator for pushing with gravitational tests over a number of years, I would say maybe 40 years. And when he and Cliff Will worked details of PPM formalism that I will be referring to, and essentially Ken is part of this development, helping us to structure the scientific objective of this experiment. With this, I'd like to go back in history, 160 years ago. 160 years ago in Paris, Le Verrier, director of the observatory in Paris, he had a very interesting year. In 1 year, he proved Newtonian gravity by discovering the planet of Neptune. And in the same year, he actually realized that there was some discrepancy in the same Newtonian gravity with the Mercury perihelion precession. So that led to discovery, that led to the anomaly that was later realized within Einstein's general relativity. So this anomalous 43 arcsecond per century was not accounted by Newtonian gravity, and only Einstein, when he published his. Before publishing his paper in 1915, he actually computed this result, and he obtained 43 arcseconds per century. That was the beginning of a new era. And essentially, later on, we know that first real experiment to test general relativity was conducted by Eddington. And that experiment was planned for a number of years, and finally it was conducted in 1919, when Eddington measured light deflection by solar gravity. And it was a wonderful time, because at that time, Eddington, before the experiment, he has three possibilities for this experiment. First of all, light will not be affected by gravity. The second line of argument was that, yes, light will be affected by gravity, but the value will be 0.87 arcseconds. And of course, Newtonian arguments, the Einsteinian general relativity said that it will be twice that amount. And you see here the telegram that Eddington sent to Einstein actually confirming that yes, they are seeing with reasonable accuracy the value that Einstein predicted. And here the two men sitting in Cambridge in the 1930s. Later on, today, we of course see those wonderful Einstein arcs in the data by HST. And so that's a confirmation of general relativity on a larger scales. And so of course, now we in a different time. But the last 35 years of being at JPL, we utilize solar system as our main laboratory. And to do that, we essentially used a number of techniques. First would be radar ranging to planets. Essentially, passive ranging, you fire a significant radar signal to Venus or Mercury or Mars, and you get echo back. So by timing this signal, you actually can resolve, you can determine the ranges to those planets. We use spacecraft, Mariners, Pioneers, Viking, Cassini, Mars, missions to Mars to measure the same very precise, to conduct very precise measurements of the trajectories. And we use this data to actually to solve for certain relativistic parameters that are plotted in this two-dimensional graph. I brought only two parameters, beta and gamma. Parameter beta, as you know, it's a measure of nonlinearity of superposition of gravitational field. We're talking about weak gravity field. We are not talking about strong gravity field that we had the conversation in 11 o'clock today here. It's essentially, it's not a cosmological phenomenon, but we deal with weak gravity. Another parameter is the unit curvature, and that is the curvature that is being produced by the unit mass. And in general relativity, both of these values are equal to each other. They actually one. So in 1976, the first significant experiment to improve parameter gamma was conducted using Mars ranging to Viking lander on Mars. And we got accuracies for gamma deviating from general relativistic value of 1 to less than 2 times 10 to the minus 3. Later on, Mercury ranging conducted to actually significantly constrain the value of possible deviations from general relativity.
Sorry, just a question. Is that the modulus and is the error bar symmetric around 1?
In this case, in case of Mars, in case of Viking, the error bar was symmetric.
It's symmetric.
Yeah, they were symmetric. And then later on Cassini, for example, we were talking about the error bars are still symmetric, and it's pretty much most of the values that are coming from astrometric field VR will not be symmetric. So moving on with this data, you see astrometric field VI. The difference in this scale is insignificant, but pretty much the deviation from general relativity is less than 10 to the minus 4, 4 times 10 to the minus 4, and this value were obtained in 2004. And then we see the possible deviation from general relativity, the space of possible deviations is shrinking significantly. Moving on in time, lunar laser ranging, the technique that was established by placing retro reflectors on lunar surface back in 1960s when Apollo astronauts actually placed those corner cube reflectors. And since then, we range into those reflectors quite routinely. So this technique was used to constrain possible deviations from gamma of gamma and beta from general relativistic values to very significant accuracy as well. And in 2003, you see that the conjunction experiment conducted on the Cassini mission constrained this space to even further. So now we live in reality that gamma is deviating from general relativistic value to less than 2 times to less than 2.3 times 10 to the minus 5. So we live in a very constrained space, and the possible deviations from general relativity would have to be somewhere within this spot. And the question would be a natural way, a natural question would be, why do we need to test further? Why do we need to go in there? Because general relativity now is applied discipline. I used to study GR back in Moscow. It was applied discipline, but now it was theoretical discipline. But now it's applied discipline. So I'm working in JPL, and for me, general relativity is applied general relativity. Why? Because in navigation, when we navigate a spacecraft to Mars, if I'm not accounting for general relativistic corrections, I'm getting kilometers of error on the surface of Mars. If I will be in the missions such as a space interferometry mission or global astrometric interferometer for astrophysics that is being developed in Europe, these missions will be sensitive to microsecond signals. And with this accuracy, you must account for deflection of light by solar gravity, by Earth gravity, by Jovian gravity as well. So you have to account for those effects continuously in order to get scientific signal. So in a way, GR now is applied this deflection. You have to account for that to move forward. But the message here I'd like to say is that it's only a factor of 100 within the last 35 years. And so this is the progress. If we want to have another factor of 10 in this area, the experiments are getting much more complex, and it's very difficult to constrain those values to a better accuracy. I will be talking about this in the next few charts, but the point here I'm saying that is essentially a factor of 100 in 35 years. It's not a good progress, and we can do better. I like the statement that Professor Jürgen Ehlers said in last year on one of the presentations in Bremen on the colloquium. He said that there were three dark clouds over general relativity. And the first one is dark energy, dark matter, and the Pioneer anomaly. I would probably put sort of a question mark here because I'm from that team, and I'd like to talk about this a little bit further because there's some discussions. But definitely, we live in the reality that we don't understand these two phenomena quite well, dark energy, dark matter. And with this, I'd like to talk a little bit about these two mysteries. This is the data that were represented in a graphical form after WMAP released the first results in 2001. And essentially, we see the dark matter here constituted 25% and dark energy 70%. With the new release of data on Friday, this number slightly changed, but the fact is, we still deal with unknown. And many theories, many people are looking for dark matter particles to explain what dark matter particles are, but we know that as an alternative to dark matter hypothesis, many people are pursuing other idea, is essentially modifying gravity. To modify gravity is not a very simple, exercise, because gravity modifications are notoriously difficult. Because if you add additional degrees of freedom in infrared, you get instabilities of ghosts. And if you work in different regime, when you talk about light, very light scalar fields, for example, added to the mix of fields, you are bound against the observational constraints. I will be talking about those in a few charts. But the point here is that as an alternative to a classical explanation for dark matter, which is search for dark matter particles, there is a significant effort now to look for possible gravity modification theories. And John Moffitt here representing this wonderful community of people who are not taking things for granted and looking outside the paradigm, looking for possibilities to actually explain these astrophysical mysteries with a new approach of thinking about physics of gravity. The Pioneer anomaly. The dark force, dark energy, dark matter, dark force would be a natural continuation of sort of dark force of dark words moving on. And spend a little time talking about the Pioneer anomaly. Michael Mieto last year came to Perimeter and he gave a talk on the Pioneer anomaly. So I should not spend time to talk in details about this, but I'd like to summarize just in a few charts what it is. We see on the data received from Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11, starting from 1979, we see a frequency drift in the Doppler signal. That frequency drift can be interpreted as the constant acceleration of that value. We studied a significant number of possible explanations for this hypothesis, for this acceleration. But until today, we still don't have a very satisfactory mechanism or theory that explains the anomaly. And over the years since the first publication of our paper in 1998 and the second one in 2002, we now have a much better understanding what this effect might be. And realistically, in the new data analysis that we are going to start in about a month, and maybe by the end of this year, maybe not September, but close to that time, we'll have a better understanding of what it is. There are still things on the table, such as systematics on board, and we would like to study more what those systematics forces can contribute to this puzzle. There are two possible origins of this anomaly: conventional physics, and which can be explained with gas leaks from propulsion system, or possible thermal mechanism, or drag force of certain origin in the solar system. But all of those mechanisms would exhibit temporal decay, temporal variations that we haven't seen with the limited amount of data that we analyzed. We looked only at 11.5 years of data received from Pioneer 10. Now, today, we have roughly 32 years of data. And as we previously looked only at 20,000 data points, we're looking now roughly at 95,000 data points. So the distances that we analyzed before were from for Pioneer 10, from 40 astronomical units to 87 astronomical units. Now we have distances from 4 astronomical units for Pioneer 10 going to 89. And for Pioneer 11, the distances are also very significant. Previously, we had only 3.5 years of data. Now we have roughly 20 years of data for Pioneer 11. And the distances from one astronomical unit to roughly, I think it's about 40 astronomical units.
Question? That value for the anomalous acceleration, is that an average over the two spacecraft?
This is the value that was determined using the data between the two, from the two spacecraft.
All right, so they're both combined together. Exactly. Are there values for each one separately, and how close are they?
The values for the two spacecraft are slightly different, and they're different in the first digit. There would be for Pioneer 11, the value is 8.8, and for Pioneer 10, 8.65 roughly.
So those within limits of error. There.
Yes, definitely. They are within the limit of error. And now the new data that we have will allow us to study the anomalous acceleration individually for both spacecraft on the same ranges. So now we can study the same, we can produce anomalous acceleration for both spacecraft from 4 astronomical units going to 40. So in this, it will be the same distance, the same scales, and we would like to do this analysis exactly to understand the possibility.
When will that?
When I will be back at JPL later this week, the data will be finally assembled mid next week. And then we will be distributing this data for the team who will be doing the analysis. I hope the analysis will be initiated in a month from today, only initiated. It's not a simple thing, and given the potential outcome of this study, it will not be public until it will be finalized. So we hope that maybe within the next 6 months, the data will be analyzed, and actually WMAP gave us a very good example how to deal with that. So we probably will release our final papers and with the data together at the same day as WMAP did. Please.
I was wondering if you see any systematic variation in the acceleration of the light scales.
There is some puzzling variation on annual cycle and diurnal cycle on the anomaly for Pioneer 10 especially. But these variations are small and not significant. So in a way, right. Most likely it is relevant to misorientation of Earth with respect to ecliptic plane. And these effects will be studied longer. Or maybe we'll see effect of, there is a lot of heat on the spacecraft. So there should be some heat present in the anomaly value. It may be quite significant. And the new analysis will tell us what exactly the fraction of the heat contributing to the anomaly. If the heat is part of the anomaly, its effect will be along the spin axis. And then the spin axis, the Pioneer spacecraft was always pointed toward the Earth because it needs to communicate with the DSN stations. It was readjusted just to follow orbital motion of Earth because at the 40 AU, the angle for readjustment was large. If you go to 70 AU, the angle of readjustment will be very small. So the readjustment was done not frequent. But still, if the anomaly is point, for example, if the anomaly is pointing toward the sun, but the heat force pointing along the spin axis, so toward the Earth, you will see this annual bias or annual beat sort of the variation in the data. And that's what we think we might be able to confirm. And so with new data, all of those questions will be addressed because we would like to understand the origin of this periodicity. We would like to understand whether or not the value for the anomaly will exhibit some temporal decay as further away we go from the sun. And because now we will have a better understanding of thermal hypothesis. In the team that is going to analyze this, data. We have thermal experts from JPL and thermal experts from outside the navigational community. So we would like to nail thermal hypothesis for sure. And if this is thermal, we have to say it is thermal. If it's not thermal, then having these people on the team will be strong reinforcement that we do this something extravehicular. So I suggest we should wait until the data will be analyzed, but this is sort of it's, I'm telling how we think to proceed, and we would like to engage as many members from the community to deal with the data, because it's a significant data volume. For example, to bootstrap our analysis, we'll be using onboard telemetry, and onboard telemetry was previously unavailable. It's housekeeping data. You have lots of thermal sensors on the spacecraft, electrical sensors on the spacecraft, and we have roughly 114 parameters of telemetry from both vehicles. The total data volume is about 40 gigabytes. It's about a billion frames of telemetry we receive from the spacecraft. Going through this data, it takes time. So even though I'm saying maybe in 6 months we'll be able to nail down the result, we'll have a better understanding, it may be slightly longer, and we'll update you on sort of the outcome when things will progress.
Just a question. What about the rise of the acceleration? I mean, people think it's after Saturn, but do you think you can pin down exactly when it starts?
It's a very good question, and in my mind, it's a somewhat controversial question, because in both papers that we published in 98 and 2002, we, especially in 98, where we first presented that the so-called onset of the anomaly, we put this figure in the paper just to indicate that anomaly was there, was known there, was known back then in 1979, 1980. And essentially, yes, JPL navigators looked at that, but the figure that is printed in this paper is not done in the same analysis. There were at least five people involved in producing separate values for the anomaly. Each of them would have their data editing strategy. They would use their own input files. They would have different attitudes to pretty much toward the data analysis. So what I'm trying to say is that the data is, in a way, it's a good data, but I would advise not to think hard about the physics of that onset yet, because it may be an artifact of the simply because we dealt with the very early data. Remember, it was 1979, 1980, when we had Earth ephemeris were sort of numbered DE 200. Now we work in reality DE 414. So we have better understanding about solar system dynamics, about spacecraft modeling, about everything. So in my mind, I dealt only with the short arc of 10.5 years of data, and this is what I can trust. Everything else that we put in, it was just to indicate the anomaly was there. So doing a serious analysis of this data, I probably would advise against that. But it is interesting, and we will be checking. It's one of the areas of future investigation will be to look exactly how the onset happens.
So is this going to be done in the next 6 months as well?
Yes. There are four main areas of future investigation. First area is to determine direction of the anomaly, because with early data, especially between 7 AU and 15 AU, we are still sensitive to direction. When we go further away, when we are at 40 astronomical units distance, our angular resolution of this spacecraft, remember it was built in 1960s, we don't have good resolution on the direction. So we can safely say that anomaly points somewhere in the inner of solar system. In the inner meaning somewhere where Earth and the Sun are in the same location. So sensitivity to the precise direction is very bad when you go far away from the center of the solar system. So with new data, we'll be able to actually study this direction and to be able to confirm. The earlier study suggested it was directed toward the sun, but I'd like to revisit that. The second area of investigation would be exactly the onset that you mentioned. The third area would be to look temporal variation of the anomaly, because we have radioisotopic nuclear generators on the spacecraft, and they are fueled with plutonium with 87.75 half lifetime. So those RTGs, so-called, they emit a lot of heat. So if heat is the origin of the anomaly, we should be able to see how anomaly value decays with time, being correlated with the heat decay, with the proponent decay. So we should be able, with new analysis, to study that precisely. And another area of investigation is, of course, looking at the two pioneers separately. We have two systems now, Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11, the same ranges, the same and the same sort of time. We should be able to understand how this anomaly behaves for the two spacecraft. And everything will be done in the same analysis that we'll be using telemetry data. Telemetry, the housekeeping information about everything on the spacecraft. So that's what will, this is what will be done with the Pioneer in the future investigation. But let me talk about the experiment that is, has nothing to do with Pioneer so far. So this is what the models that were proposed to explain the Pioneer anomaly were very interesting. Where they were from different walks of life, people were proposing a big, significant number of different ideas. And first of all, the numerical coincidence that A sub P, the value, is essentially C times H, speed of light times Hubble constant, generated an avalanche of papers, so that we are seeing cosmology on local on a local scales. So I don't want to judge these papers, but I think we understand that this was just a numerical coincidence. I'd like us to reconfirm that with new data and see what actually, if we have any other, any further information. But what is interesting, the gravity modification theories, they seem to be explaining this phenomena together with other phenomena, the galaxy rotation curves. For example, papers published by John and Joe, very interesting in a way that it sheds new light on how things might be interpreted in the scale of the solar system. And so I'd like to sort of to warn that this is very interesting development, and let's wait when we'll have all the data in hand, we'll analyze. I personally try to stay away from any theoretical information because I'd like to sort of to do honest job with data analysis. So I will not be judging, I will not be commenting on those theories, but they're just an indication of spectrum of different possibilities. So this is what we see on the data from 87 to 98. You see that sort of a little wiggle here as you were asking me about annual variation this year. And remember, this is the residual that you that we see by modeling frequency that we would receive from the spacecraft. And this is the observed frequency. The difference between the two frequencies may be modeled with a simple sort of phenomenological equation, where A sub P is the value that we determined. So essentially, frequency translates into velocity measured and so on and so forth. But now, if we use only one additional parameter in many parametric model, and the residuals actually lying flat. And remember, the frequency to compare with is 2.3 gigahertz, and the residuals are in millihertz. So pretty much 12 orders of magnitude of signal have to be adjusted, have to be modeled. So this is the quality of the feed, and those sort of spikes, it's a solar corona, because once a year, the sun is essentially starts to transmit through solar corona. And so the effect of solar corona, you see, it's very prominent. Additional data analysis was done by then postdoc Craig Markle from Goddard Research Space Flight Center. Craig just received the data that we put on the NSSDC, National Space Science Data Center. And he took the data, he wrote his IDL code, and this is what he got, similar behavior. And so this is just after the fit with one still not adjusted, it's still, you see residual acceleration here. But now when he put additional parameter in, the residual is actually very flat as well, it's in millihertz also. So that's, there's an, a few more analysis done recently confirming that anomaly is in the data. Now the question is, what is the origin of this? And this will be answered, I hope, by the end of this year. Moving on. So let's go back to the challenges for general relativity. And we know that if general relativity will be quantized, it will probably not survive, it will have to be modified. So the quest for quantum gravity generates significant amount of work trying to understand how gravity can be quantized. And many publications deal with the problems in classical description. That in the classical description, you know that there is a breaks down, the description actually breaks down on the regime, in regimes of large curvature. And cosmology, the WMAP data actually stimulates us to think about possibility of gravity modification. what all of those theories have in common is scalar field. So most of them have scalar field. Scalar fields might be massive, maybe massless. And essentially, most of them have additional fields in the model. And this is exactly what our mission will be looking for. The mission will be looking for possibility of additional fields beyond the standard general relativistic description of gravity. And search of possible scalar partners can be done looking at a search for violation of equivalence principle, looking for a large-scale modification of gravitational and cosmological phenomena, testing variability of fundamental constants, and of course, conducting gravitational tests in the short and long distance in the solar system. One of the models I'd like to sort of present here is Thibaut D'Amour and Ken Norgard in 1993, together with Alex Polyakov. They looked at the simplified Lagrangian from the string theory. In the low energy limit, the coupling function of dilaton field to the metric tensor essentially might be expanded in terms of the around the background value. And the parameters gamma and beta that we discussed previously are directly relevant to the derivative of this coupling function. So now, if you have a scalar tensor theory, you can test those low energy approximations, for example, from the spin theory by measuring gamma and beta, because they are now relevant to real physical values from coupling function of dilaton to regular matter. And studying the cosmological evolution of scalar field, Thibaut and colleagues found that gamma in certain scenarios will be deviating from general relativistic values at about 10 to the minus 5 to 10 to the minus 7. So it's an indication that if you push a little bit further, so possibly at the regime of 10 to the minus 6 for gamma deviating from general relativity, we'll get to the very interesting regime. And this is one of the motivations for our mission to actually to consider. But let's see what can be done in the near future. First of all, remember that the best measurement of gamma came from Cassini mission when, during the conjunction experiment, Cassini spacecraft sent radio signal from very precise radio system, advanced radio system, back to Earth. And the radio signal actually deviated from its path because of the solar gravity. And this effect was measured to the significant value. What other techniques are available? Let's look at the possible astrometric VLBI using radio frequencies. VLBI, a very long baseline interferometry. Currently, the value is 4 times 10 to the minus 4. And this technique essentially will benefit only from getting large, from enlarging their data set. Essentially, they will gain only on statistics because technology is not changing there. What they have, they're now moving from single dish to VLA and moving into sort of distributed baseline interferometry. But significantly, you need to beat a solar corona. Therefore, you need to move to higher frequencies, 33 gigahertz, 60 gigahertz. So this is the sort of regime you need to be operating. VLBI is not working in 60 gigahertz. It's only 30. It's only in the regime of 30 gigahertz. So realistically, the only advancement will come from increasing the data volume. Currently, they have 1.6 million of pairs of stars observed in the solar background. Increasing this by a factor of 10 will buy us only a factor of 3. So realistically speaking, we might expect in 5 years to have accuracy in 10 to the minus 5-ish regime. But it's very difficult to get there. Lunar laser ranging essentially going through a renaissance, because now we have a new instrument that is operating in New Mexico that will be able to reach a factor of 50 improvement in the range sensitivity. Now we have roughly 2 centimeters range accuracy, post-fit accuracy between Earth and the Moon. And this instrument will go to millimetric class accuracies. So with this, we do expect to have a significant accuracy increase. And in addition to testing parameter eta, which is it's a strong equivalence principle dilating parameter. We should be able to get g dot over g. It's a temporal evolution, possible temporal variation in gravitational constants, which should increase to at least by a factor of 10.
I'm just a bit surprised that millimeter accuracy in the position of the surface of the Moon can translate this accuracy into the center of mass. Because we don't know much about the constitution of the body.
This would be the main effort in the upcoming 6 months to understand. We have a good understanding of range behavior to a centimeter class accuracies. But some effects were accounted, some effects we see that we need to account. For example, thermal expansion of retrograde reflectors on the lunar surface, because the temporal variation between day and night, remember those reflectors were installed not in the polar area where the sunlight, where the eternal sunlight, they're actually installed in the low latitudes, so that there is a day and night. And the temperature between day and night goes by 250 degrees. So those 250 degrees affecting the reflector each 14 days change the length of the reflector by at least 8 millimeters. So we have to account for those effects. But you will be surprised that the moon actually is very well, is a very, very interesting body. It's a very good belt. It's a very good, it has very good conductivity. It's very stable because there is no selenic quakes, because all the seismic activities are about factor 10 to the minus, it's about a factor 10 to the 8th down compared to Earth. And we know a lot about moon now. We know that the moon has a liquid core, and the liquid core, we study the liquid core motion, because liquid core is moving inside the moon, and with moving, there is a non-zero velocity difference between liquid core and the whole moon. So we see those biases, we see those obliquity of the core, we study those effects. We know a lot about the moon. And so those millimeters are not scary, but I think accuracies are going below millimeter. I wouldn't trust, because realistically we would hit a geophysical limit under, let's say, 0.1 millimeter. I don't think we'll get there ever. But realistically, with a lot of statistics that we will be able to achieve with this instrument, we get to that accuracy. Just a measure of, just to compare with current techniques. For example, when McDonald Observatory fires their laser to the moon, they're sending roughly 10 to the 19th photons per pulse, and only one photon coming back every 100 pulses. With this instrument, we should be able to get at least 5 to 8 photons per pulse. So it's still not a huge number, but it's a significantly different regime. It's multi-photon regime detection. So in this case, we will benefit from a lot of statistics with the, when we working with this new instrument. So moving on, the microwave ranging to lander on Mars will probably increase the accuracy by a factor of 10 compared to VLDI. And the limits there will be essentially those introduced by the asteroids, because asteroid belt produces another fundamental limit in the solar system, because range Earth to Mars range is fundamentally limited by the uncertainties introduced by asteroids. The largest 150 asteroids perturb the range between Earth and the Moon larger than 15 centimeters. And some of them are perturbing the range even to a meter. And those masses and those influences of those asteroids, we don't really know well. We model them as a class density, CS, and so more, not individual asteroids, but sort of classes. Understanding asteroids to much better accuracy would be a very limiting, will be needed, but even then, we should be able to get to accuracy only to that level.
So just to clarify, I think a moment ago you said between the Earth and the Moon, did you mean Earth and Mars?
Earth and Mars, I'm sorry, thank you. Between Earth and Mars. So this is a very fundamental limit introduced by asteroids.
So just a question, in the JPL website, there's a code, an n-body code, which you can actually put a million things.
Yes.
So this excludes these effects.
I think JPL ephemeris include roughly 2,000 largest asteroids. And the remaining asteroids are modeled as classes. So the largest asteroids are known really well, and we have a significant program to study those asteroids. You know this encounter problem, if you have asteroid hitting the Earth, so now NASA contributes significant amount of money to study possibility of encounter. So this results in the improving, ephemeris of asteroids.
So what is a class? A class is just like a fluid you put in a kind of...
Because we, the only way to model them, you look at the reflectivity and the inferred density. And so we compare the reflectivity of those asteroids and possible density and the classes of those asteroids. We just model them as classes because we don't know their shapes. We know pretty much what would be the density of this asteroid. And given the uncertainty in shape, we can compute mass. But it's very, there is a fundamental limit how accurate can we do ranging to Mars. And therefore, any range, any laser range, any future range or accurate positioning that will require to have precision distance between something around Earth and outside the asteroid belt will be very difficult. So that pushes us to have those instruments placed in the inside of the asteroid belt. Only there you can actually model ranges to very high accuracy and benefit from this. Moving on, there are some effects that I mentioned. For example, the additional gravity models that were proposed to explain CMB data. And if you include a generic Palatini Lagrangian, you know that it probably has it's unstable, there are some ghosts, but I'm just indicating that if you include just a generic Palatini Lagrangian in the formulation of general relativity, where f is just a generic function of curvature, then parameter gamma and beta may be represented from the may be constructed based on the derivative of this function. So it's another motivation to look for possible support of any theories that will be proposed to modify gravity or to explain cosmological phenomena. We can actually test those theories in the solar system scale by improving measurements of these two parameters. And the point here I'm trying to make is that our laboratory is really our solar system. So the solar system is where we conduct our experiment. And making this is a controlled environment. And in this controlled environment, we can fly a mission and can perform experiment to very high accuracy, as opposed to receiving a signal from a source that is far away, and we still need to understand the properties of that source. It's still very interesting physics to study extreme curvature, extreme field regime, for example, double pulses or binary pulses, or studying cosmology. It's very important, but I'd like to emphasize the fact that solar system offers very unique conditions to conduct controlled experiments. And we know very well the environment around Earth, but unfortunately the gravity around this environment, characterized by 10 to the minus 9 as a dimensionless parameter. If you move to the Sun, the intensity of gravity increases by a factor of 1,000, but this is as much as we can get in the solar system. Unfortunately, we don't have this knob to increase gravity, as probably in high energy physics, you still have a possibility to build a larger accelerator and or look for cosmic ray for cosmic rays coming to Earth. It's at least you have an opportunity to vary gravity. But in our case, we live with what we got, and the solar system is our environment. So coming back to the experiment that I would like to discuss is the laser astrometric test of relativity. This is a...
Before you get to that, can I interrupt the question, then maybe you'll come to that in a moment, but if you're looking at at an accuracy in gamma of 1 part 10 to the 6, say, and post Newtonian effects would be also corrections of 1 part 10 to the minus 6 to the post Newtonian terms, doesn't that mean that you have to augment the theory to include post Newtonian terms and also increase the number of parameters you need to fit for, and therefore maybe degrade the accuracy to determine the post Newtonian parameters?
In our analysis, we are looking for effects of post Newtonian order and proportional to g squared, and essentially, in addition to parameter gamma and beta, have to include parameter delta. Delta is a spatial component of metric tensor, and that parameter was never measured because we were never sensitive to that parameter. So parameter delta is now included in the model, and if we fix parameter beta, because we will never be able to achieve beta accuracy better than lunar laser engine, for example. So if you fix one parameter in the simulations, we get a very good measurement of delta. If we allow delta to be if we allow beta to be free, in this case, our accuracy is slightly less, but still very very impressive. We still get gamma to 10 to the minus 9 and beta determined to 10 to the minus 5, sort of getting to this regime. And delta is an accuracy of 10 to the minus 4 as well. So it's still very impressive in terms of compared to what is possible. In addition to that, we can measure J2 of the Sun. We can also do a significant improvement into lens steering effect, because the effect of solar rotation on the light propagating in the Sun from, sort of, we will be observing the Sun from one direction and will be re-emerging from another direction of the Sun. So solar rotation will contribute to deflection of light. We are sensitive to this as well. So we will have to have a fully relativistic model of the light propagation, including all effects of the second order gravitational constant.
Okay, thank you. So but what I was worried about is that by fitting more parameters, you probably lose a little bit in the accuracy by which you can measure the main parameters. Is that?
It's not a concern. We are not getting a significant reduction in accuracy. I would say it's only 3% maximum in this case, it's not a concern in this case. So, but it's a valid point. We thought about enlarging the number of parameters may result in decreasing our accuracy, but not that it's still very good. But so this is an experiment. What we do, we launch a spacecraft, two small spacecraft on the same launch vehicle in such a way so that they will be positioned opposite to the Earth. And the distance between the two spacecraft, as seen from Earth, would be about 1 degree. So that would form roughly 5 million kilometers. It's like a LISA distance between the two spacecraft and LISA mission. But then the distances here from one spacecraft to the point around Earth will be about 2 astronomical units, and here the same distance. What we do, we accurately measure distances between these three fiducials in space. So all of those fiducials are of this triangle in space, we measure the length of those distances. Now, if you know Euclidean geometry, for example, we can, based on just Euclidean geometry, we can compute angle here. Of course, in curved space-time, it will not be a simple equation like that. But realistically, the notion here, if in addition to measuring distances, we can, and being able to compute that angle, we can measure that angle directly by using an interferometer. And interferometer we want to position on the space station. By measuring this angle directly, we, in a way, bootstrapping our system for observation, we get redundancy benefiting our experiment. And this is the main idea. So the accuracies that are required, not very significant. The distance has to be measured to 1 centimeter. And measuring distances of which are indicated with these red curves here, red lines here, 1 centimeter, it can be achievable. We just recently acquired the signal from messenger spacecraft that was traveling at about 27 million kilometers from Earth going towards Mercury. And the accuracy of laser ranging with this spacecraft was very impressive. So we don't see any problems to get to accuracy 1 centimeter. And just for comparison, LISA will be able to determine this distance between these two spacecraft, for example, in their case, to a few microns. So in a way, we are not pushing for drug-free technologies. We don't need drug-free technologies. Therefore, it's not a LISA-class mission because we are not using drug-free technologies. It's a simple system that will be relying on radio navigation. And the angle to measure between these two spacecraft will be measured to 0.1 picoradian. And that may be an interesting number because it had never been done before. But the technology development that we have at JPL enables us to claim this number as well, because the SIM space interferometry mission is able to determine similar parameters for their instrument. Moving on, the first order effects, of course, we know it's one.
What determines where the two spacecraft are located, their orbital parameters? Is this fairly arbitrary, or?
We have a very good navigation performed for both spacecraft.
No, I believe they can be tracked. I'm just wondering, is there some particular type of orbital parameters that optimize the experiment? I mean, LISA's out of Lagrange point, for example. Does it matter where these spacecraft are relative to the Earth to do the experiment? Is there a best place, or is there a lot of choice in this system?
There is not a significant constraint on that. We chose a 3-2 Earth resonant orbit in a way that to enable this experiment to be conducted 3 times each 7 months. So, but the idea is to position one spacecraft. It's not a static picture. Imagine these two craft actually. What's happening? These two spacecraft after launch, in about 13 months after launch, they approach first conjunction. So the sun is here, there will be the first spacecraft, the light from the first spacecraft will start touching the solar limb. Then it disappears, it reappears behind the sun and moves slightly in a different direction. And then they come back, and another one time, and once more. So pretty much the idea is to position the spacecraft behind the sun in the most sort of least expensive way. And the least expensive way is to position them exactly on 1 AU distance. Why? Because if you want to position them here, you would need to kill the orbital momentum of Earth orbital momentum, and that costs money because we need to have lots of propellant and need to have a lot of sort of a different launch vehicle. If you move them here, it's additional strategy. So the cost function is what actually determines the position of this
spacecraft. That's what I wanted. So there is an optimization.
Optimization in terms of cost, overall cost.
But that coin is not L3.
It's not L3. No. There is no L1, L2 consideration in this case because we are not requiring, we are not requiring a stable orbit here. It will just move in this way and then another one, and then in 3 years this orbit will repeat itself. We have at least 3 experiments in 7 months. This is what we are looking for. So I think in a matter of time I should probably skip a few slides, but moving on. First order effects, we know their values. The second order effects, we are sensitive, they will be 3.5 microsecond on the solar limb. And we will have 100 meter baseline on the International Space Station. And the distances, the accuracy of that baseline will be measured to roughly 5 picometers. 5 picometers is not a big number. We already demonstrated this on our space interferometer mission. So with this accuracy, with 5 picometer accuracy, we get a significant signal to noise ratio on the second order effects, which is pretty much the effect will be measured to 1/1700. We are sensitive to frame dragging, to quadrupole moment, and those are the sort of the corresponding values that will be achieved in our experiment. The point here is that this experiment was originally proposed with interferometer on the ground, but atmospheric effects degrading the sensitivity of the laser range and determining the angle of position, and also the baseline had to be significantly larger. It's rather 30 kilometers, which is quite difficult to build. So on the ISS, we achieve everything. We have all in space, all the 3 nodes in space, and we achieve a significant accuracy by just moving them in space. So this is what interferometer is doing. A single interferometer essentially measures the dot product of baseline and the direction of the incoming light. So essentially, it's a projection of the incoming light on the baseline vector. This is a single interferometer. In our case, there will be 2 interferometers on the ISS. Why do we need 2? Essentially, one interferometer will be pointed always on one spacecraft. Another one will be doing chopping, switching between one to another, between one to another. And the idea, we will be forming an independent differential measurement of the excited angle between the 2 spacecraft by doing that. And that will help us to reduce the extended structure noise that we have on the ISS, because ISS is a noisy environment. We are not avoiding that. ISS is a very noisy thing, but we can deal with that putting nano G accelerometers on the space, on the ISS, which is very standard technique now, and using this chopping, which will allow us to actually reduce the dynamical noise of the ISS. This is the technology development in the JPL. Essentially, we're benefiting from the space interferometry mission. That is a very healthy program, and the overall cost for that mission is rather $2.9 billion, which is supposed to be launched now in 2015. But the technology that is needed for SIM is already accomplished. This is exactly what will be used for our mission. In 2003, the accuracy that they were able to achieve, roughly 24 picometers back then. Now the accuracy is below 5 picometers. And so that is where we get in our main technology for the spacecraft, for this interferometer to be placed on the International Space Station. Essentially, we're looking exactly at the solar limb, and let's just focus directly on the sun, because with optical technologies, we are now less sensitive to solar corona, because the effects of solar corona, the dispersion of solar corona proportional to lambda squared. And essentially, we are moving from micron size wavelength, from microwave to optical, from centimeter to micron. And squaring the two, we are actually better off by a factor of 10 to the 10. So we get in 10 orders of magnitude better sensitivity in just getting through solar corona. We have done simulating the sun as a continuous source, and we were able to observe the monochromatic light of the laser source going exactly behind the sun and almost touching the solar limb. So that is what is going to happen. And just to give you a little bit more impression, what we're dealing with, it's a very noisy environment. Sun is a very noisy source, but if we implement a certain technique for canceling the solar noise, we can deal with the issue very in very stable environment. What do we do for that? Essentially, just what I'm trying to say here is the solar spots, the solar flares. The solar flares are huge here. This is just comparable size, just to compare to the size of Earth here. And the solar flares are a very significant source of noise here, of course. So this is what we would have to deal with. And solar activity, this is the number of solar spots, so it indicates 11 cycles of solar activity. We have to account for all of those effects, and we have to plan in advance, knowing when will be launched, what will be the solar cycle, and how many solar spots will be there. But realistically, what do? Essentially, before we'll receive the signal on our interferometer, for example, we have a narrow bandpass filter over the whole aperture that kills significant amount of solar corona or stray light, not allowing this in the system. The design here, I don't want to stay very long on this picture, but the main element here is a narrow bandpass filter. It's only few angstrom wide with respect to the central wavelength. And then we have a coronagraph. Coronagraph allows us to block the sun completely, so that in the narrow filter we see the laser light actually approaching the solar limb, and we don't see the sun because we're blocking it with the coronagraph. And then when the spacecraft light reemerges from the other side, we do the same on the other side. And you see that before light comes to the aperture, the sun is a very bright source. It's minus 26 magnitude of the sun, and on the detector is only plus 6. We achieve a significant reduction in the stray light, which actually allows us to make that measurement on the interferometer. So this is where we'd like to position the instrument. You see the space station. Of course, it is not being built, and after Challenger and Columbia especially, the whole planning here was affected significantly because that mission supposed to be flown in 2011 because we had plans to go through MIDEX, which is medium class explorer proposal cycle 3 years ago, but then the accident with Columbia pushed everything back, and now you know the situation in NASA is even worse because the plans for ISS is a very difficult topic. And we are happy that Europeans are joining us, and Europeans essentially, I will show the team from European Space Agency who is actually working hard to position the interferometer on these pallets, S6 and P6 process, which will enable us to achieve the 100 meter baseline that we need for that. And essentially, ISS is a very good source because of the need to get electrical power, the solar panels will be looking at the sun all the time. So they actually have the ability to look at the sun exactly. This is exactly where we need to point. So we're pointing at the sun, and so the ISS is actually a very good platform for us. As I said, after launch, in about 15 months, we achieved first conjunction. So the red is one spacecraft, blue is one spacecraft, and essentially we, in 7 months, we see three conjunctions conducted within this mission. This is what we are going to see, hopefully. And so the light disappears behind the sun. And this is the summary of what we are going to measure. We hope to measure parameter gamma to a factor of 50,000 better than is currently available, provided by Cassini. And realistically, there are no other mission that, no other experiments, non-dedicated experiments will be able to achieve even a close accuracy. So if you want to achieve that accuracy, we need to think about a dedicated mission. We will be able to measure parameter beta to 0.01%. We'll be able to measure parameter delta, as we discussed in another spatial component in the metric, to 10 to the minus 4. J2 will be measured to 10 to the minus 2 as well. And so there are other effects. So this is the summary. And pretty much this is the history of relativistic experiments in the solar system, the way we'd like to see it. In 1919, Edison's experiment confirmed general relativity to roughly 10% accuracy. Viking experiment in 1980 constrained this parameter gamma to a better accuracy, and it was 0.1% of accuracy. Cassini, a significant improvement in the measurement, and we hope to achieve these sensitivities in about 2016 to measure parameter gamma to 10 to the minus 9. And so this is a team that is working hard to develop this mission. You see many familiar names For example, Thibaut d'Amour is from France, and Ken, Tom Murphy, Yana, Sean, Ron Killings. So there are many colleagues whom we know quite well in the community. They're very happy to support the mission goals. And of course, the technology development is now affected by political considerations. We hope to overcome this difficulty and fly this mission when possible. Thank you so much. I'm sorry I took a little bit longer than I wanted to, but thank you very much for your attention.
So, any questions?
Yeah. How about other questions? Or bit of
Nordwit effect is the effect to measure a strong equivalence principle violation on the moon, for example, or with planetary bodies such as Jupiter, such as Jovian satellites. This mission is very sensitive to this effect as well. We will be sensitive, I think the parameter eta will be measured to 10 to the minus 5. We didn't put it as one of the parameters because by that time we hope lunar laser engine will achieve better accuracy.
And
about two questions.
First, what's the
space
of gravity probably?
Close the doors.
Turn off.